The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So before going into our discussion of student struggles in the present day, I wanted to start with a few historical examples of how students have fought for social change in the past, because I think that this can offer us some really important insights into how we can successfully organize today, and perhaps even more importantly, can raise our expectations of what kind of social change we can actually achieve as students and workers. So of course, this is the 50th anniversary of 1968, a year in which massive social upheavals against the Vietnam War and against racism shook U.S. society to the core. During this time, campuses were an epicenter of social struggle, and student organizations both responded to these wider social movements and contributed to them in significant ways. For example, in 1968, students at Columbia united with working-class residents of Harlem to challenge gentrification, racism, and imperialist war. After the university bought up large amounts of property in the surrounding neighborhood and evicted thousands of residents, student groups like Students for a Democratic Society and the Student Afro-American Society disrupted the construction sites and occupied four buildings on campus. As Dorian Bond notes in Socialist Worker, the students involved in these occupations not only demanded the end of the gentrifying policies in Harlem, but also called for the termination of military contracts made by the administration, a university statement against the Vietnam War, greater black representation on campus, and increased democratic governance by students, faculty, and staff. When the administration tried to put down the student movement with brutal police repression, students, faculty, and staff united in a strike that shut down the university for 6 weeks. Ultimately, the students won all of their demands, and the university president was forced to resign. 4 years earlier, in 1964, another student struggle was playing out on UC Berkeley's campus. This was the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, and like the upsurge on Columbia's campus, it tapped into the broader social movements at the same time that it pressured the university administration with immediate demands. The Free Speech Movement began in response to a series of attacks on students' right to political organization and speech. This was a significant blow to the civil rights organizing that many of these student groups were involved in at the time. In response, Berkeley students formed a broad coalition of political groups, some of the most influential of which were the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, and the International Socialists, and organized the largest student sit-in in U.S. history up to that point, and shortly afterwards launched a student strike. After weeks of protest and repression by the administration and police, the Berkeley students finally won their demands, including the right to have public political meetings on campus. This movement, as Samuel Farber notes in Socialist Worker, radicalized hundreds of students and opened the way for further political organizing on campus, especially when it came to the civil rights and anti-war movements. So the 1960s were clearly a high point for social movements on campus, but the student struggle was by no means limited to this decade. Its roots extend back to the early 20th century, and as we'll see, continues to this day. Beginning in the 1920s, as Ibram Kendi notes in the Black Campus Movement, black students used direct action, nonviolent protests, strikes, walkouts, and boycotts to win better living conditions, as well as more control over their studies and curriculum. During the Great Depression, communist and socialist students built a national movement to win democratic rights, support the labor movement, and combat fascism. At Columbia, communist students launched a movement that successfully pressured the university president, who was a fascist sympathizer, to agree to boycott Nazi Germany. More recently, in the 1980s, students at Columbia organized a movement against South African apartheid, and after occupying the business school and launching a hunger strike, these students finally forced the administration to divest from South Africa. Now, that's a lot of history for a panel on the state of student struggles today, but I think it's important to understand the history of radical organizing on campus, because this can give us a sense of how student movements emerge, how they can successfully win demands from university administrations, and what kind of challenges they'll face. One lesson we can learn from this history is that universities, despite their efforts to portray themselves as isolated centers of learning, are never separated from social upheavals occurring outside of campus, and that there is a close mutual interconnection between student movements and wider social movements. We saw this in the case of the communist student movement and its connection to the wider labor movement, in the case of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement and its connection to the civil rights movement, and we saw it in the case of the 1968 protests at Columbia and their connection to movements against racism and against the Vietnam War. Student movements are most radical and effective when they are closely connected to these broader struggles. So another lesson we can learn from these past movements is that just like any other struggle under capitalism, student struggles will be met with resistance from the representatives of the ruling class, in this case, university administrations, every step of the way. Sometimes, as in the case of the examples you just covered, administrations will go so far as to use the police against their own students. But even when the repression is not so severe or so explicit, university administrations will still try to find ways to demobilize student movements, whether that's simply by refusing to grant their demands or else by punishing them with disciplinary action. In all three of the examples, which I'll discuss later from Columbia this past year, the administration has used both methods in order to fight back against student movements. This is because universities, like almost any other institution under capitalism, are sites of class conflict, and the administration, whose interests are largely allied with the ruling class, don't share the same interests as the majority of their students, faculty, and workers. So this understanding of the university as a site of class conflict can help us to understand the social and political conditions that shape student struggle. For instance, neoliberalism and the employer's offensive against working class living standards that have shaped US society for the past four decades have been playing out on universities as well. We can see this in terms of the growing unaffordability of college tuition, which is one of the causes of the growing student debt crisis. We can also see it in the proletarianization of many higher education jobs, such as increasing reliance on the labor of lesser paid workers, like adjunct professors and graduate workers. And along with this, university administrations have tried to limit the ability of their workers to fight back by denying their collective bargaining rights, as we'll see with the example of grad worker unionization at Columbia. So by understanding this ongoing neoliberalization of higher education, we can better understand the factors that push students towards the development of a radical anti-capitalist outlook. And we can see as well the way in which student movements can unite with labor struggles on campus on the basis of their shared interests in order to win demands from university administrations. So now that I've covered some of the history of student movements in the US, as well as the social and political conditions that shape present-day struggles on campus, I want to discuss a few recent movements at Columbia that our ISO branch has been involved in this past year. In particular, I'll discuss first the growth of the right wing and the issue of free speech, second, the Palestine Solidarity Movement on campus, and finally, the graduate worker unionization struggle. However, these are by no means the only important recent student movements at Columbia. For instance, beginning in 2013, there was a significant movement against sexual violence on Columbia's campus, in which students demanded increased accountability from the administration in sexual assault cases and formed groups to provide support for survivors. Students have successfully pressured the administration to divest from fossil fuel companies, to divest from private prisons, while environmental justice groups continue to pressure the administration to divest from fossil fuel companies as well. Shortly after Trump's election, groups like UNDOCU successfully pressured the administration to declare Columbia a sanctuary campus. And most recently, a group of students occupied the Student Center for 4 days to demand 24/7 healthcare, including a rape crisis center, available to everyone on campus. So there are important lessons to be learned from all these movements, but I want to focus on the protests against the far right, the BDS movement, and the grad student strike, not only because each of these struggles reached a high point in the last year, but also because they're clearly connected to issues and movements currently unfolding on campuses across the US. So first, the growth of the right wing on campuses and the issue of free speech. I'm discussing these two topics together because I think that many of the confrontations between the right and the left in the past year have centered around this question of what free speech actually looks like on campus. This has certainly been the case at Columbia, where the major protests against the far right took place in the context of a series of events held by the College Republicans called Free Speech Month. So any student movement aiming to confront the far right on campus will need to develop a coherent response to this question of free speech. Monique Dawes argues in the ISR that, quote, the revolutionary socialist perspective requires that we chart an independent approach that both defends the right to speak without intervention of the government or campus administrations, while it also embraces and builds up the capacity of left and progressive forces to protest and fight back against reactionary ideas and, more critically, reactionary policies and actions, end quote. So in other words, the best way for left-wing groups on campus to confront the right-wing is through mass protest. The specific tactics that we adopt in each case will depend on the situation. Sometimes, for instance, in cases where there is truly mass support for a protest, it might make sense to shut down a right-wing event entirely. At other times, it might be enough to simply protest outside the event or to silently hold up signs inside. The key point is that left-wing groups on campus should insist that this act of protest is not an attack on the right to free speech, but rather is an integral component of it. And it is this kind of free speech, not the quote-unquote right of multimillionaire right-wing ideologues and media personalities to hold expensive events at elite universities, but rather the right of students and workers to engage in protest and struggle, that is under attack on campuses right now. And the absurdity of the situation is that more often than not, this attack on students' right to protest is being done in the name of quote-unquote free speech. So to see how this question of free speech and fighting the right can play out in concrete situations on campus, I want to focus on a series of protests that took place at Columbia against some right-wing speakers invited by the College Republicans. These speakers included Tommy Robinson, a founder of the English Defense League, which is a far-right Islamophobic anti-immigrant organization, and Mike Cernovich, a right-wing conspiracy theorist and anti-feminist. Not only did the university administration provide these far-right speakers with the auditorium of the Student Center to hold their events, but they also sent large numbers of police officers to guard the auditorium. It was clear that the main purpose of these police officers was to intimidate potential protesters. And yet, despite this intimidation, hundreds of students turned out to protest both outside and within the auditorium. The university administration responded by punishing student protesters, banning the students who had protested inside from attending College Republican events in the future. Throughout the rest of this so-called Free Speech Month, the administration continued to clamp down on student protests. The next protest erupted in response to Mike Cernovich's event. But this time around, the administration actually locked the entire student center to everyone except those who had exclusive tickets to Cernovich's talk, and again guarded the building with police officers. In spite of this high security and the threat of disciplinary action, about 100 protesters gathered outside the student center. This time, though, they were met with right-wing violence. One of our members in the ISO was actually physically assaulted by one of these right-wing counter-protesters. Yet the administration remained more concerned with punishing student protesters for supposedly disrupting Cernovich's right to free speech than in protecting their own students' right to protest. So far, I've focused mainly on the administration's complicity in shutting down student protests against the far right. But now I want to turn to an even more important question, which is what role were we as socialists able to play in these protests and in the broader fight against the far right on campus? I think that the Columbia ISO branch was able to play a pivotal role in the Cernovich and Robinson protests because we were able to put forward a uniquely socialist perspective on the issue of free speech, and our approach to tactics was informed by this perspective. Many other student groups either adopted the liberal approach of ignore them and they'll go away, or alternatively tried to convince the administration to shut down the event. In contrast to both of these methods, the ISO aimed to build a mass protest outside and within the events. We knew that a protest with widespread support would do more to shift consciousness on campus than either ignoring the right-wing speakers or trying to shut the events down from above. And I think that this approach really paid off in the case of the Robinson protests especially, because these protests quickly became about far more than just whether or not Tommy Robinson should be invited to speak on our campus. It became about challenging the growth of the far right in Europe and in the United States, confronting Islamophobia, and standing in solidarity with immigrants whose rights are increasingly under attack. These broader political issues could only successfully be raised in the context of mass student protests. So now I want to transition from the issue of fighting the right to discuss the current state of the Palestine solidarity movement on campus. But the connection between this movement and our early discussion of free speech is certainly quite clear, because one of the additional elements of hypocrisy in the debate over free speech on college campuses is that the single greatest threat to free speech rights in the university is not at all directed towards the right wing, but rather against individuals and groups who stand in support of Palestinian self-determination. Activist groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, or SJP, and Jewish Voice for Peace, or JVP, have long had to deal with right-wing Zionist intimidation and blacklisting, as well as threats of disciplinary action from university administrations. Yet despite these challenges, pro-Palestine student groups have continued to organize in campuses across the country. The growth of SJP chapters nationwide has been a key factor in the growing support for the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement. Since 2004, students at more than 50 U.S. colleges have voted, often by overwhelming margins, to divest from or boycott companies complicit in Israeli apartheid. At Columbia, student activists in the Apartheid Divest Coalition have organized protests against far-right Zionists like Danny Danon, and each year during Israeli Apartheid Week, they set up a mock apartheid wall in the center of campus to protest the Israeli occupation. Most recently, SJP activists held rallies in solidarity with all the people who were killed or injured in Gaza this past year. Rallies and demonstrations like these have played a key role in shifting consciousness around the issue of Palestinian self-determination. And last semester, this led to an important victory for the BDS movement on Columbia's campus. Activists in the Apartheid Divest Coalition initiated a referendum at Barnard College, which demanded that the administration divest from 8 companies complicit in the Israeli occupation. A substantial majority of Barnard students voted in favor of this referendum. But soon afterwards, the Barnard administration released a statement saying that it would not respect the democratic vote of their students, and that it would continue to refuse to divest from these companies, showing again how little support university administrations really have for student democracy or free speech when it comes to left-wing movements, and especially when it comes to Palestine. So at the moment, this BDS vote remains only a symbolic victory, but I think that it could act as an impetus for further struggle on campus around the issue of Palestine. As we've seen in the past, if a student movement is strong enough, then it can force university administrations to agree to boycotts or divestment, even if at first they seem dead set against it. We saw this at Columbia with student socialist and communist students who forced a quasi-fascist university president to boycott Nazi Germany in the 1980s when students organized movements for divestment from apartheid in South Africa, and more recently at Columbia with the successful movement to divest from private prisons. We'll need the same kind of mass support and organizational commitment in order for the BDS movement to succeed at Barnard and other college campuses around the US. And so finally, I want to end with the state of the labor struggle on campus, and in particular, the struggle for graduate worker unionization. At Columbia, grad workers have been involved in a more than decade-long struggle to organize a union. In the past, despite widespread support for a union, their organizing efforts had been thwarted by a 2004 NLRB decision, which ruled that graduate students were not workers with a right to collective bargaining. In 2006, the NLRB reversed this decision and gave graduate workers the right to legally unionize. In an article published at Verso, Bill Mullen notes that this opened up a period of widespread unionization activity in higher education. In these past 2 years, graduate workers at 16 private universities, including most recently at Harvard, have voted to unionize. Graduate workers at Columbia were the first to unionize following the 2004 decision, with nearly 75% of the graduate student body voting to form a union. But the Columbia administration refused to respect its democratic vote or to bargain with the new union, and continues to insist that its graduate students are not workers. This is actually a violation of federal labor law. And basically, the Columbia administration is just stalling as long as it can in order to wait for the NLRB to fill up with Trump appointees, which they hope will then overturn the 2004 ruling. In the meantime, the administration has continued to pay massive amounts of money to union-busting law firms and has done everything it can to damage the unionization struggle. This kind of union-busting behavior is unsurprising given that collective bargaining rights have been under attack at universities across the country. The issue of unionization, like that of pro-Palestine activism, is another area in which the administration's rhetoric of free speech and democracy tends to ring hollow. Health workers at Columbia have similarly been denied the right to bargain with the university, and adjunct professors at Barnard almost had to go on strike last year to demand a better contract. And so it was in this context of neoliberal attacks on the rights of workers in higher education that graduate workers at Columbia decided to organize a strike. After a strike authorization vote passed by an overwhelming 93%, they announced that if the administration didn't agree to bargain, then they would strike during the last week of the semester. In response, the administration only doubled down on its anti-union rhetoric, and so for 5 days, grad workers organized massive picket lines, rallies, and demonstrations on campus. The demands that they put forward during the strike were far-reaching. In addition to calling for better pay, they aimed to win better health insurance, childcare subsidies and parental leave, sanctuary campus status for international and immigrant students, and due process for sexual violence and harassment cases. The striking graduate workers argued that these important gains could only be guaranteed through unionization. This is especially true in the case of sexual assault, because as a group of grad workers wrote in an article called Why Women Graduate Workers at Columbia Are Organizing for a Strike, quote, unionization provides workers legal resources and allows precisely the third-party mediation of cases that our institutions have frantically tried to avoid, end quote. In addition, striking groundworkers in an echo of the 1968 protests put forward demands to end ongoing gentrification by Colombia, now in the form of a new multi-million dollar expansion into Manhattanville. And finally, graduate workers were clearly influenced by the reemergence of a militant labor movement across the United States. There's no doubt that the teachers' strike wave played a major role in providing grad workers with the confidence they needed to launch a strike. The graduate worker strike didn't force the Columbia administration to the bargaining table, but it marks one of the most radical upsurges of student and worker struggle on the campus in at least the past few decades. There are a few points I want to emphasize. First, that workers and students' movements on campuses are always interconnected, and that they can only succeed if there is solidarity between them. During the grad worker strike, the Columbia administration attempted to pit undergraduate students against graduate students, trying to convince us that by going on the strike, the grad workers had somehow undermined our educational experience. The majority of undergrads responded in the same way that high school students responded to the teachers' strikes, with solidarity, expressed in the slogan, "Their working conditions are our learning conditions." Undergrad student groups like Student Worker Solidarity organized teach-ins and rallies in support of the unionization struggle, and many undergrad students joined the picket lines. This is because most students understood that they shared far more in common with the graduate workers on the picket line than they did with the union-busting millionaires and the university administration. And the second lesson that I think we can take away from the grad worker strike is that socialist groups on campus can play a critical role in labor struggles in higher education. In our ISO branch, we had a number of grad workers who were closely involved in the strike, who, despite their relatively small numbers, were able to infuse a current of socialist politics into the strike. Despite the general anti-socialist bent of some of the more conservative union leaders, ISO members involved in the strike were able to put forward arguments for more militant tactics and more far-reaching demands. These efforts didn't always succeed, but nonetheless, our members were able to influence the politics of this struggle by emphasizing issues such as sexual harassment on campus and by drawing connection to the recent strike wave in K-12 education. The grad workers' strike then was a powerful example of how socialist politics, student movements, and labor struggles on campus can come together to produce a radical upsurge that challenges the neoliberal model of the university. This struggle isn't over yet, but it's already shown what kind of social power students and workers possess, and how they can leverage that power to improve their own conditions and to challenge the capitalist status quo in higher education.
Hi, everybody. I am a 33-year-old undergraduate. I don't know if you can see the gray hairs, but I have some. I've been trying to get a college education for like 15 years now. Full-time, part-time, dropped classes, failed classes, dropped out of college several times, five different colleges. I had experience with, I owe $30,000, which many people owe much more. I wouldn't default on my student loan debt and couldn't go to school for years until I had to pay out of default. My wages were being garnished. Working as an instructional aide at a public school, so like you really can't afford to have your wages being garnished at that. I go through all of that to say that that's a pretty common experience. I mean, maybe 15 years is a long time, but people really struggle through college now, and it's a pretty common thing. So 40% of 18 to 24-year-olds are enrolled in college and in the United States, and 60% of adults, people over 18, have some college education or experience taking college classes. But it's still a minority of people who actually graduate with a college degree. Maybe 15 years might be on the extreme end of things, but like it's not that atypical of an experience that people are going through now. Of course, there's nothing wrong with me or with any of the other people who struggle with similar or worse types of adversity trying to access an education. There's something wrong with our system of education. And what it is that we have a capitalist system of education. There was just an amazing author speaking in the last session, a theorist called Wayne Au, who wrote a great book called Marxism and Education that you can get in the Haymarket Books Room. And he talks about the capitalist education system in that book. And he says that it's a capitalist education system because it does a couple of things for the capitalist system. The first is that it reproduces capitalist social relations and inequalities. It does so by transforming most students into workers for an extremely uneven and hierarchical labor market. Some people go to elite schools and become people that make decisions about society, but most people are transformed into workers when they go to school. What the education system does is it sorts people and it puts them into their places. So speaking for myself, given that my father never graduated from high school, that my mother did not receive her bachelor's degree until she was nearly 50 years old, it shouldn't be surprising to anybody that I've struggled through college. That's just sort of the place that I've been put by the system that we have. And the education system does even more for capitalism than that. It plays a role of reproducing capitalist social relations and inequality, sorting people in their places. At the same time, it plays an ideological role that legitimates and rationalizes those same capitalist social relations and inequalities. The ideological power of the capitalist education system is not even primarily about the way that teaching and learning is conducted inside of classrooms, actually. The ideological power of the capitalist education system lies in the way that it supports this myth of a meritocracy. We are led to believe that this system is based on something called equality of opportunity. Those that fail are only supposed to have themselves to blame. Maybe they were too lazy, they just did not work hard enough. Maybe they held too fast to a so-called culture of poverty. And those with enough hard work and grit are able to succeed, despite whatever obstacles they might face in their life. Some individual students may overcome the obstacles to their success, but they only provide evidence to prove the myth of meritocracy. That, you know, these people worked hard and they got ahead. And in their majority, individual students generally do not overcome the structural obstacles to upward social mobility by way of education. So, and the two functions of the capitalist education system, social reproduction of capitalist social relations and ideological legitimation, they sometimes actually come into conflict with one another, especially during times of economic crisis and austerity. So if, for example, during a recession, politicians respond to less demand on the labor market for educated workers by cutting education budgets, and as a result, nobody can register for the classes that they need to graduate, it becomes difficult to believe that the system really is based on merit. That contradiction played a role in the development of an anti-austerity student movement in California about 10 years ago. I'm going to discuss that. It was really a mass student movement that took place. But I'll get to that in a minute. There's a second contradiction that sometimes plays a role in the development of student movements also. This contradiction is internal to the way that capitalist education functions ideologically. And it's pretty simple. When students are told that they are all equal, sometimes some of them actually come to expect equality. These contradictions can create space for students to resist capitalist inequalities and to develop critical consciousness. Again, this is not original thinking on my part. Read Wayne Au, Marxism and Education. All of this, though, it doesn't mean exactly that we should expect the year 1968 or 1964 to repeat itself over and over again in history. The student radicalization of the 1960s was a specific historical phenomenon when largely middle-class students left a home life shaped by a broad social consensus and contract conservative cultural conformity, as well as a McCarthyite anti-communist political scene. And then they were rapidly radicalized on recently expanded college campuses, shook by the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War. That relationship between student struggles and the world around them will not repeat itself. But the contradictions internal to capitalist education do help to explain why student struggles have been such an important part of wider social and class struggles for justice throughout our recent history, and why we should do what we can to prepare for more struggles on campuses in the future, struggles that will have their own specific relationships with the world around them. So I'm a student in Berkeley, California. I got my Cal shirt on. It's a place that does have a rich history in student struggles, but in many ways, our more recent experiences are relatively impoverished when compared to other places, in even in North America. So the students in Quebec, for example, have a vibrant tradition of combative student unionism and assembly-style democracy that they have been building for some 50 years now. Their extended, massive, and disruptive general strike in 2012 had a hugely positive impact on the class struggle in that part of the continent. Students in Mexico, like students in the US, do not have a tradition of student unionism like that of the Quebec WA. But since 2012, Mexican students have been central to several waves of social struggle. Those waves of struggle have amounted to what our comrades in the Partido Revolucionario de las y los Trabajadores have called a state of widespread and permanent protest against the hyperviolence, corruption, and authoritarianism in that country. And that state of permanent protest played a big role in the crisis of the ruling Partido Revolucionario Institucional that allowed for this recent historic electoral victory of the populist reformer Andrés Manuel López Obrador and his Morena Party. So again, our experiences in Berkeley and in New York City and in other places in the U.S. are relatively impoverished, and we should be looking abroad to learn from more developed student movements. But nonetheless, we do have some experiences that are worth assessing, and we have a responsibility to try to develop some common perspectives that can help to guide our struggles forward so that we might catch up with our international comrades. So I'm going to try to do some of that. First, I'm going to, with about 15 minutes, hopefully I can get through most of this. I'm going to talk about what took place in California about 10 years ago, starting in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008. The state government imposed a regime of extreme austerity measures that slashed spending on public education, healthcare, social welfare. And in response, students protested in their thousands for several years. This was a mass movement that shaped the political terrain on California college campuses that we're navigating today. Second, I want to discuss some of the specifics of student struggles in Berkeley since the rise of Trump. There are many similarities to what Emmeline just discussed in Columbia. Berkeley, however, it seems, is one of the places that the most violent elements of the emerging fascist movement in the U.S. Has targeted, and so that's a real challenge for us. And it's a high-stakes fight. Also, not coincidentally, Berkeley is also one of the places with something that you could call a labor left. So I'll talk about some of the things that we're trying to do to support the revival of a fighting labor movement there. And then third, I'd like to wrap up by inviting everyone here to think seriously with me how socialists and other radicals might begin to organize a student and worker-led movement for free public education for all, which is a demand that has become very popular in recent years. So first, California, 2008. There was a financial crisis. It shook the whole world, but one of its epicenters was the housing market in California. And the crisis hit that state incredibly hard. So the state economy contracted by 4% in 2009, compared to about 3% for the U.S. as a whole. And in 2010 and 2011, the growth was slower in California than the rest of the country. And these economic problems intensified already what is extreme social inequality in that state. So the Census Bureau Research Supplemental Poverty Measure was at 23.5% during this period, higher than any other state in the United States, What they call deep poverty was at 6.3%. People of color, of course, were disproportionately poor, especially immigrants with a 25.8% poverty rate and so-called Hispanics at 27%. There is Appalachia or Mississippi Delta-like poverty in the rural areas of California. But people often underestimate the level of poverty that exists in the affluent coastal cities due to extreme cost of living. And these economic problems also intensified a long-term structural crisis of governance in the state. There had been a tax revolt of suburban middle-class homeowners led by right-wing populists in the 1970s. They imposed severe limits on property taxes as well as rules that required a legislative supermajority to pass a state budget. State budget stalemates became a regular occurrence in Sacramento in the decades that followed. Budgets were on an average of 11 and a half days late in the 1980s. In 1992, the state issued IOUs. In 2003, budgets were 31 days late on average in that decade. In 2003, the Assembly Speaker forced a budget by locking legislators inside the chamber overnight. The state Senate had its own lockdown in 2007. And IOUs were again issued in 2009. Budgets averaged 55 days late the first 10 years of this century. The tardiest budget was 115 days late in 2010. Most of the economic assumptions were already out of date by the time the budget was passed. On top of all this kerfuffle and confusion, an energy pricing scandal resulted in Democratic Governor Gray Davis getting recalled and bringing in the bizarre governorship of Arnold Schwarzenegger from 2003 to 2010. So I think it's safe to say that at this point, the government in California was lacking in what we would call legitimacy. An intensified austerity regime was imposed after the crisis of 2008, on top of the already 30 years of austere governance. Total expenditures on healthcare, public education, and social welfare were reduced by tens of billions of dollars year after year. One effect of all of this was there was ever-increasing tuition for college students in the public education sector. Governor Schwarzenegger and the heads of the public education system actually had met, and they had made a deal in 2004, and they agreed to increase reliance on student tuition. By 2011 and 2012, student tuition had surpassed funding from the state in the UC budget, raising the question of whether these were public universities at all. Student tuition became the largest source of operating funds by 2012. So tuition and costs increased across the country, but they increased at a faster pace during the post-recession austerity period in California than anywhere else. The state ranked below the median of tuition costs in 2004 at 34th, but by 2013, the state ranked above the median, 21st in the nation, with 115% rate of increase compared to 93% in Illinois, 70% in Texas, and 40% in New York. At Cal Berkeley, there's been a 1,000% increase in tuition in the 40 years between 1975 and 2005, and a 70% increase since 2008. So that was sort of the situation that students were facing at the time. And socialists thought that there would be a resistance. The semester of fall 2009 started with a deceiving quiet. Nobody was doing anything when it started, and we were all kind of shocked. But then things started happening really fast. It's important to be prepared even when things are not moving quickly so that you can seize the time when they do start to move. And what happened was that there was faculty started getting upset that they weren't being included in decisions about the budget cuts. They weren't even opposing the budget cuts. They just thought that they should be able to have a say in how the budgets were cut. And they wrote a letter calling for a day of protest on September 24th. And there ended up being small demonstrations on college campuses across the state. There was a large demonstration at UC Berkeley, though. About 5,000 people had a rally. And they made a call for an organizing conference the next month. That same day, there was a building occupation that took place at UC Santa Cruz, and occupying buildings on campuses would become like really the fashionable thing to do that semester. On October 24th, we had a general assembly of some 800 unionist students and activists at UC Berkeley, and there was a debate about what to do. This is, I think, an interesting tactical thing. The debate was, should we have a strike, or should we have a strike and day of action? And what ended up winning out was this idea of having a strike and day of action, and the thinking behind it was that, well, some people would be able to go out on strike, but there was very low level of organization, and so many places would not be able to pull off a successful strike, but it was important that they did something in solidarity with the others that were taking strike action. So we had an argument. Some people were like, no, we just gotta strike, you know? But the strike and day of action tactic would end up being successful. We set the date for March 4th. We also set a day of action date for November 17th. There were occupations of campus buildings on that day at San Francisco State, at UC Berkeley, and there was very intense police repression of these occupations. But that just ended up like making everybody angrier. At the same day, on November 17th, there was this big rally at UCLA where the UC Regents were meeting to vote on a tuition hike, yet another tuition hike. And thousands of students tried to like basically storm the UC Regents meeting and fought with police at the barricades who were trying to protect this meeting that was going on. There was more repression, people got more angry. By the time our March 4th strike and day of action in 2010 came around, it was a real mass action. We estimate that maybe 200,000 people participated up and down the state. So there were, I think there's somebody here that may have participated in one of these actions. In Oakland Public Schools, people picketed in the morning. So there wasn't a strike in the Oakland Public Schools, but there were thousands of students and teachers and parents picketing their schools in the morning, holding, you know, practicing what a strike might look like. At the UC Santa Cruz, the students actually shut the whole campus down. They took a strike action by organizing pickets that did not allow anybody to enter the campus. And in San Francisco, high school students and teachers organized a walkout in the second day, the second half of the school day, and 20,000 people ended up marching, students, teachers, parents, on the city hall. And they had a big rally. So anyway, we thought that this strike and day of action formulation that was based on the idea of how do we get the most people to take action with the sort of organizational capacity that they have, we thought that that was a vindicated. But then after March 4th, 2010, there was a lull that kind of set into the movement. And I think that it's useful to kind of try to understand why that took place. There was repression of student activists. But there were limits to our organizing. We basically, students didn't have any form of organization, really. We were operating on this like general assembly model, which was taken up by the Occupy movement the year before. But there wasn't any kind of permanent organizing body that people could get plugged into and to do organizing work. But the biggest, I think, reason why that movement started to sort of lull and dissipate was that there was starting to be a turn towards, well, now we got to get Jerry Brown, the Democrat, elected to governor in the fall of 2010, and he's going to help us. So we tried to do more days of action, and they failed. I think there's a lesson there about the independence of social movements from politicians in government. Because Jerry Brown ended up passing the most austere state budget in the history of the state in 2011 and 2012. And there was little in the way of resistance like under Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger that we saw. There was a second round of struggle that did happen when Occupy Wall Street took place in New York in the fall of 2011, and it spread not only to the cities of California, but to college campuses up and down the state. There were spectacular assemblies and occupations and clashes with the police on the campuses in the state. And I'm really speeding up. I don't have enough time to go through everything I wanted to. But basically, there was we were able to get through all of that agitation and organizing. There was an initiative that was taken by the California Federation of Teachers, sort of getting enthusiasm and support from the student movement to pass something that we called the Millionaire's Tax, which was an initiative very similar to what the teachers are trying to push in Arizona this fall, to tax the 1% to pay for education. And this passed. And so the movement was somewhat successful. Tuition hikes have been frozen at the state level in California ever since. Campus-based fees continue to go up, but at the state level, tuition hikes have been frozen. I only have a few minutes left. I'm not going to talk about the stuff about the Trump era, because I think Emily touched on it. The stuff that we're doing at UC Berkeley is very similar. The far right has targeted college campuses. Columbia's one of them. Berkeley's one of them. They talk about free speech, but it's really not about free speech. It's about violence and intimidation. The administrations and the college Republicans are complicit in facilitating the violence and intimidation of the far right. It's a very high-stakes battle that we have to take seriously. The campuses are also a place where we're seeing the revival of a fighting labor movement. And so the campuses in the big states, there's these big public university systems in California, in New York, Texas, Florida, Illinois. These are huge parts of the economy. So the class struggles that are going on in these public education systems, these are not just fights that are symbolic or ideological, but are real material battles that students can weigh into. I'm just going to wrap up by putting out a sort of half-baked proposal that I've been thinking about recently, which is that there's a radicalization going on in this country. There's a political polarization taking place. It's not completely generational, but it's concentrated amongst young people. So we should be fighting to build socialist organizations on the campuses. But not all of the students are going to join socialist organizations. Are there other forms of organization that we can build alongside socialist groups on campus? Things like student unions, committees that can organize solidarity for the labor battles that are going on campus, and campaigns that we can advance to fight for this idea of a free education for all. I think it's a programmatic idea that is developing across the country that is gaining popularity. And if we begin to organize student committees on the campuses around the country, we're going to be in a much better position to fight when the next economic crisis comes around, when there's a turn towards harsh and extreme austerity again. We want to put ourselves in a position that is stronger than the last time when we fought in California. When we fought bravely, we had some success, but we didn't have organization to really sustain our fight. And so I think we should be thinking about the sort of programmatic things that we can really start to lay the basis for mass student politics in this country. I think it's possible.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.